Welcome to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker.
We interview Scholar Circle founder Maria Armudian, who's published a book on international human rights and the role that international lawyers have played at advancing cases against human rights abusers.
But first, we explore the violent suppression of protests in Central Asia and the possibility that it may become a genocide. Protests across Central Asia in the former Soviet republics of Tajikistan and Uzbekistan have rocked those nations. The state's violent suppression of these movements have killed hundreds and undermined human rights protections, transparency, and peace in those nations. In Tajikistan's eastern Gorno-Badakhshan Autonomous Oblast, the home of the Pamiris, the government has used security forces to attempt to violently put down a series of protests. In Uzbekistan, in the region of Qoraqalpakstan, is a sovereign republic, but that distinction seemingly has only seemed to have existed on paper, and the government sought to remove the distinction, and so local protesters have risen up. And in that case, the government has responded violently as well. On today's show, we will explore the roots of these conflicts and what these violent crackdowns mean for human rights, democracy, transparency, and peace in the region. Our panel for this segment is Steve Swerdlow, Associate Professor of the Practice of Human Rights in the Department of Political Science and International Relations at the University of Southern California. He's a human rights lawyer and expert in the former Soviet republics, and was senior Central Asia researcher at Human Rights Watch, heading the organization's work on Uzbekistan and Tajikistan, as well as founding its Kyrgyzstan field office. He's the author of Uzbekistan's Religious and Political Prisoners and Uzbekistan's Ethnic Minorities, Out of Sight, But Not Out of Mind. And Suzanne Levy-Sanchez, visiting scholar at Harvard University's Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies. She is the author of The Afghan Central Asia Borderlands, The State and Local Leaders, Bridging State and Civil Society, Informal Organizations in Tajik Afghan Badakhshan, and The Assassination That Shook the Pamir Mountains to the Core. Thank you both very much for joining us and sharing your expertise in this region. I'll start with you, Suzanne. This conflict, these protests in Tajikistan, what's going on? What's the nature of the protests? What's at the core?
Thanks for having me. I'm honored to be here. Tajikistan is a diverse country of many different ethnic, sub-ethnic groups. And Gorno-Badakhshan is populated with a majority group of Ismaili Pamiris or Pamiri Ismailis. And the rest of the country is primarily non-Pamiri Tajik Hanafi Sunnis. And the Ismailis is a Shiite sect. And that's important because prior to the formation of Tajikistan, Gorno-Badakhshan was an autonomous area. And when Tajikistan formed, it remained an autonomous province. And then when Tajikistan became an independent state after the fall of the Soviet Union, Gorno-Badakhshan maintained its autonomous status. So it's been autonomous even prior to the formation of the Tajik state. Well, there was a civil war in Tajikistan from 1992 to 1997. In which these sub-ethnic groups and ethnic groups fought each other. And it was a very bloody civil war. And there was a reconciliation finally. And part of the reconciliation was that the different groups were going to have a joint governance system. And Gorno-Badakhshan was going to remain autonomous and various leaders would also be in the government. But a few years after that, the president, who was not elected at the time, but chosen through a series of different legislative shifts, I shall say, President Emomali Rahmon, he decided slowly over time that he wanted to consolidate power under his ethnic group. And he began eliminating leaders across the country, various informal and local leaders. The last of the holdouts of these leaders was in Gorno-Badakhshan. So that's the underpinning of this. There was a bloody crackdown by the government in 2012, 2014, 2018, and then 2021, and then now. There have been numerous human rights abuses. So in 2021, in the recent one, they shifted, they put in a new, installed a new governor in Gorno-Badakhshan. There was a young man named Gulbuddin Ziyobekov, who had beat up the local prosecutor a year before. And they hadn't gone after him because he beat up the local prosecutor because he had sexually assaulted a young woman in his district in Gorno-Badakhshan. And this new governor decided he was going to go after him, and he let the prosecutor go arrest him and then shoot him in the head. And people were extremely understandably upset, and they protested in November. Then there was a small group of civil society leaders named Group 44, and the agreement between the government and the locals was that Group 44 would work with the prosecutor's office to investigate this murder or this killing. And over time, there really wasn't an investigation. The Tajik government then said the investigation was closed. The locals kept saying they were going to protest. So finally, May 14th, they announced, we're going to protest. At this point, they were arresting various people and continuing to crack down in the area. The protest occurred May 16th. And then after that, in a neighboring district in Gorno-Badakhshan, a military convoy was coming to assist with the protest because it was the Tajik government had shot into the crowd and the protest had gotten a little worse. And then the locals in a district named Roshan blocked the street, and the Tajik security forces started shooting at them. There were different reports about how many people were killed in that, 21 to 40. There were bodies that surfaced that had been tortured and mutilated. And then the Tajik government proceeded into Kharok. The bloody crackdown continued. And then they assassinated first Colonel Mahmoud Bokhair, who was a beloved local leader that they'd been wanting to eliminate for quite a while. Then they killed two more leaders. And then they started arresting many other people, including shutting down all the major businesses owned by Ismaili Pamiris and nationalizing them. They started a fire in the main bazaar and then national and took that business over. And they also arrested Ofat Khanum. She's a well-known human rights activist and journalist, as well as a number of other human rights defenders, as well as journalists. They also began to shut down the Aga Khan Foundation, Aga Khan Development Network, institutions, schools, etc. So they basically started persecuting and marginalizing the Pamiri Ismailis in the region, and they've continued to do so. The last thing I'll say on that is they've also extradited and arrested and tortured many people from Moscow. And so Pamiris have begun to flee Moscow into Belarus and Lithuania, and a number are seeking asylum and protection. I personally have also helped some Pamiris who are being hunted by security forces in Kyrgyzstan, by the Tajik security forces, out of the country, or one in particular, I should say. And I think that the crackdown is going to continue, and it is beginning to look like the targeting of Pamiri Ismailis is on the edge of a genocide. So there's no more protests because they've killed many of the local leaders and they've arrested almost all the other civil society leaders. So there are various vocal protests throughout the international community and the Pamiri diaspora and those of us who work on the region.
It sounds like this is not a question of the government cracking down protests any longer. It's more of a deep-seated conflict or deep-seated human rights violations that really is now being described more like, you know, atrocity rather than necessarily crackdown. Steve Swerdlow, same question to you, but about Uzbekistan. What is at the core of this, you know, the protests and the violence in Uzbekistan?
Thanks for having me back on Scholar Circle. And it's great to share the platform with Suzanne, leading expert on what's happening in Tajikistan. Well, I'm right at that point in my semester where I'm teaching students about Soviet nationality policy, and I'm trying to explain what an autonomous republic is, what Lenin and Stalin established in the 20s, which has bequeathed this legacy of so much instability. And I guess you asked in the beginning, sort of what links these two, and While I would agree entirely with Suzanne that what we see in Tajikistan is on the verge of a genocide and it's characterized by almost an entire lack of restraint on the part of the Tajik security services and security forces, what we see in Uzbekistan, what would link them together is that what we're talking about in this tumultuous summer of protests and crackdowns in Central Asia is precisely an autonomous region on the opposite end of Central Asia, so in the far northwest of Uzbekistan, so diametrically opposed. If you're looking at the Central Asian region, you go to your far northwest and you reach the Autonomous Republic of Karakalpakstan, which also has its own story. It was attached or incorporated into the Republic of Uzbekistan in 1993. Note that's 2 years after 1991, which is when Uzbekistan gained independence. In that period of time, there's a lot of debate about what Karakalpakstan's proper status was. The Karakalpakstan opposition movement says that an agreement was formed early in Uzbekistan's history where the former president, the authoritarian president Islam Karimov, agreed to allow the Republic of Karakalpakstan to have and retain an autonomy within it, and that it would have notably the right to secede, which if, you know, for Soviet experts out there and history buffs, that was actually also the defining characteristic of the Soviet republics, was this right to secede if and when they chose to do so, or at least that's what Lenin told us would be the case, although we know that was sort of a fallacy in many ways. And there's some parallels with the situation in Uzbekistan. So in 1993, Karakalpakstan becomes an autonomous region incorporated into Uzbekistan. But in reality, it was subservient to Tashkent in almost every way. But the Karakalpaks, who most people had never really heard of before the events this summer, it's an ethnic Turkic group. They speak a language that's closer to Kazakh than to Uzbek. They historically lived a nomadic lifestyle. Their language, though, is distinct. They have national symbols. And they have the trappings of statehood in a way that were very significant, symbolically important for the people of Karakalpakstan. That is, they had a parliament. They had a chairman of the parliament that functioned like a president of the autonomous region, a flag, education in their own language in some cases, although that was really restricted by the government. And so to not be too lengthy about this, this summer, the government rolled out parliamentary, constitutional, I should say, amendments to the constitution that would pave the way for the now President Mirziyoyev, who came to power in 2016, to rule more or less indefinitely. These amendments would zero out the constitutional term. They'd create a new constitution allowing him to run again beyond the 2 terms he's currently serving his second term. And everyone thought that was the main event. But while everyone was looking in that direction, when we still don't know exactly who proposed these amendments, someone on the president's team or the president himself proposed, why don't we just strip the autonomy, liquidate the independent status, the autonomous status of Karakalpakstan? Let's just solve that issue for ourselves. And who knows? Some are speculating that this is because of fears of a Ukraine-like situation. Maybe it was the fears of Russian incursion, or maybe it was simply just wanting to consolidate power. But this appears to have been done very haphazardly. It leads to immediate discussions in social media. And some of the activists in Karakalpakstan, journalists and lawyers get together. They say, we want some peaceful demonstrations. We do not want to pass this referendum. We do not agree with our autonomy being stripped. They called for peaceful meetings. And what happened on July 1st were thousands and thousands of people came into the streets in Nukus, the regional capital. And it was a remarkable event. It may have been the largest protest in Uzbekistan's modern history, perhaps even larger than the 2005 events, which are notorious now, the Andijan massacre, when previously government forces killed protesters. So this was very big. It was a lightning rod. And the government came out in full force. They used disproportionate force. They killed, we know, at least according to official sources, 21 individuals. That includes law enforcement, 4 people. But according to human rights groups, the number is higher, maybe something closer to 46, hundreds injured and hundreds detained. And now in these past 2 months, Uzbekistan has been cracking down on the independence movement. It's detained many of the ringleaders of the protests that appeared to be peaceful. And so it's got a lot of, it's very reminiscent of the 2005 events. And there's an eerie connection in a way between Tajikistan, where one minority has been under threat, and as Suzanne said rightly, in a way, their cultural identity, their religious identity, their linguistic identity, their physical identity is at risk. And I think the same is true in a different way in Qoraqalpakstan, although it's being carried out with a little bit more restraint, a little bit more savviness. The government has allowed a so-called parliamentary commission to investigate the events. And so they have appeared to learn some of the lessons of the outrage from 2005 and have tried in a way to gussy up a local investigation, which is not properly independent. And that's where the concerns and the focus and the attention now seems to be, which is whether this investigation, quote unquote, is really meaningful, is really independent, and what will happen to the ringleaders of the protest? Will there be justice for those that were killed on July 1st and July 2nd? That's in a nutshell.
You listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the protests and the government's violent crackdowns of protests in Uzbekistan and Tajikistan with Steve Swerdlow of the University of Southern California and Suzanne Levy-Sanchez of Harvard University. Now, it seems to me that these issues of identity and, you know, issues of diversity, autonomy, et cetera, that have kind of lingered. I guess, what is it about this last summer that caused so much of a violent crackdown? I'll throw out a hypothesis, and Suzanne, you can respond first, and then Steve, is there's not a lot of outside powers paying attention. The U.S. is withdrawn from the region, obviously, as a result of withdrawing from Afghanistan. This isn't terribly far from the Xinjiang region with, you know, China. And obviously, we know about the violence in that region. And of course, Russia is not paying much attention, I wouldn't imagine, because of everything that's been going on in Ukraine. So is this kind of a security dilemma where this is something that the state has sought to do, and now that nobody's really paying all that close of attention to it, they're able to pull it off?
A great question, but I would say it's almost the opposite in Tajikistan, because there's a different set of states taking notice, and the West, so to speak, US, UK, EU, have largely pulled from the region. We still are funding in the US, certainly, and so are other Western countries, but China has taken a lot of notice, and Russia has shifted its strategy radically. So I'm just going to briefly talk about those a little bit because it's really important. So the Taliban takes over. China largely supports them, and so does Russia. China sort of says to the Taliban, you better control this border region and let us have a say in it along where the Uyghurs come down in Afghanistan through the Wakhan Corridor. At the same time, they also pressured Tajikistan to get control of this restive, uncontrollable, autonomous region on its border, because they wanted to A, increase trade, and B, make sure the security situation didn't blow up on either side of the border. And there were also rumors, which I think I should bring up, is that there's the potential of uranium being sent or bought by China. I haven't been able to confirm it. I have two sources that have said this, can't confirm it. But I do know that it's a possibility. And if they do want to go along the Pamir Highway between Tajikistan and China, uranium has a very short life on the road. And that it does have to be clear. And the road did go through parts of Gorno-Badakhshan that were controlled by local leaders. And one thing I want to add to that, to build off of what Steve was saying in terms of the autonomy, while Qoraqalpakstan had more of a former autonomous Soviet Socialist Republic autonomy, I believe. So it was more sovereign territory, whereas Gorno-Badakhshan was an autonomous province, and there's a difference there. But what is really similar to me, and I didn't quite know this, is they were allowed an autonomous leadership. So they did have local leaders in each district that were sort of informal leaders, and they also had elected local neighborhood councils. And they also, as part of the deal, had the ability to tax the trade and traffic that went through Gorno-Badakhshan. The local autonomy also gave them a slightly an informal way to tax. So the government of Tajikistan tried to take that away in 2015. There were huge protests. And so now they have taken that away entirely. So all that autonomous leadership and any autonomy, and they can't change the borders per se, formally take away the autonomous oblast status, because it would change the borders essentially of Central Asia, because they were all demarcated and delimited during the formation of the Soviet Union. So there are a number of borders that are being contested, like between Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan and whatnot. Well, if the autonomous oblast of Gorno-Badakhshan is the autonomy formally taken away, that would change that border, which is always autonomous. And then everybody else could start, you know, questioning. So they're finding a different way to take it away by basically purging any kind of leadership. And then the second thing I'll say more in brief is that Russia had always kind of played a dual game, which they do well, and they supported both Tajikistan and the Pamiris. Since the Ukraine war, they needed more of Tajikistan's support, and they also needed to recruit more Tajiks and Pamiris into the fight. And so it has just been in the recent few months that they really have thrown the Pamiris under the bus and started allowing extraditions. I'm also told that the Tajik government has paid Russian security forces many millions of dollars to get these extraditions to occur. So those are huge changes from these outside powers.
Steve, so the same question about outside powers in Uzbekistan.
I think Suzanne touched on many of the relevant players and changes since, and she's more of an expert on Central Asia post-Taliban takeover of August 2021, although Uzbekistan also notably did support the Taliban. And overall, I think Suzanne would agree, although there always was a club of dictators that used organizations like the Shanghai Cooperation Organization to prop up their authoritarian tendencies and sort of glad hand and congratulate one another on fighting so-called extremists and terrorists, I think now they're doing so even more shamelessly, and that, you know, the United States' voice, the European Union's voice have become even more timid. And of course the Taliban issue has accentuated that, because there's been a need for yet again to have a very transactional relationship with both Tajikistan and Uzbekistan on the part of the United States. That is to say, please help us evacuate military equipment when we need it. Please help us, you know, get our people, so to speak, out. But other than that, you know, we understand that we have to play nice with you, because now we have even less leverage over there in Afghanistan. I think that just puts the United States on the back foot. And unfortunately, it's always bad for human rights when that happens. I think Suzanne understands this probably better than I do, which is Russia is, I'm perpetually confused by this, especially when it comes to Karakalpakstan, which is Russia's role. Because on the one hand, the exiled Karakalpak opposition movement, they liked to, and there are very few of them, by the way, I should say that we have no idea how widespread the actual call for independence was. And I should say, after the protests in July, President Mirziyoyev, unfortunately, predictably, just as his counterparts in Kazakhstan, as you remember, Doug, in January when they had protests, they blamed everything on foreign forces. Rahmon has done that at times as well. But, you know, Mirziyoyev blamed this on foreign external actors. And what I'm confused by, again, is, as I was saying, Russia's role in this, because the nascent opposition had, in a way, invoked Russia or wanted to play the Russia card and say, Russia, please come save us. We are an autonomous republic. We want to be like Donetsk. We want to be like Luhansk. We want to be independent of Tashkent, which, of course, that prospect is absolutely scary for Tashkent and for the Uzbek government. And so there's one line of thinking I have, which is that the Uzbeks did this really wanting to, as I said, do away, dispense with the idea that anyone outside of or inside of Uzbekistan could take advantage of the situation, including Russia and what it's doing in Ukraine. So I think that did play into the decision to do away with the autonomy. On the other hand, though, as Suzanne said, Russia allows these governments to use repression to put down any sort of threats to their rule. And so they really prop up what security forces do. And I think certainly the president of Uzbekistan thought about that. And of course, he also had in his mind that Russia had intervened in Kazakhstan in January. If you remember the bloody January events, the Russian-led CSTO organization sent troops to Kazakhstan. So it's all very, very complicated when it gets to Russia. But at the end of the day, I think your question was the correct premise, which is that as the world and this region becomes both less seen, less heard, more transactional, more authoritarian, and as these dictators remain in power year after year, they become naturally more paranoid. And I think that that only increases the tendency to eliminate opposition, put down revolts where they can, and to do so where need be with violence.
Suzanne, you've made references to this being at least perhaps the first stages of the possibility this could potentially lead to genocide in Tajikistan. I'd like to explore that a bit. What is it that is suggesting to you that this could become a genocide? And if so, how do you imagine this is going to unfold?
It's a good question. I mean, talking about, I'm not a genocide expert, although my dad did escape the Holocaust. So in family history, it was constantly talked about. The reason I've brought that up is one, Genocide Watch wrote a report about it, and they said that Tajikistan is currently in the fifth stage of a 10-stage steps in genocide. I'm not going to be able to cite each stage, but what I can do is outline a few things, which is they've seized property, they've relocated people, they've massacred people, they have separated people out, they have taken away their right to practice religion, they have tortured them, they have killed them, they have interrogated them, and they have sought them out in other countries to extradite and kill and torture as well. They have also stopped them from speaking their or studying their local language. They have arrested cultural leaders. There's 11 distinct local languages in this area. It is an extremely rich, diverse cultural area that only has 250,000 people. And one statistic that was pointed out to me is that if the same number of people, 40, were killed in the US in proportion to population, I think the number, if I'm not mistaken, was something like 67,000 people would be proportional to the population. That is a very large number. And that was just that massacre, but they've also killed others. So when you think about genocide or a serious persecution of a religious and ethnic group, you know, you have to think, are they allowed to own businesses? No. Are they allowed to go to the schools that they have? No. Are they allowed to have access to the economy? No. Are they being killed? Are they being tortured? All those things. So that's why I think they're not there yet. So when we talk about sort of forecasting where that could go, my feeling is this, and it's a bit dire, is either the international community is really going to step up, and they have been a little bit, but not enough, to say, you're going too far here and you need to stop. And there's over 300 prisoners that are have false imprisonment with, that have not had a right to a fair trial in prison right now. So, you know, there needs to be an outcry and there needs to be a public display against that, sanctions, whatever it needs to be. Number two, if that doesn't happen, and they continue, they have been this slow trickle of arrests that have been slowly increasing of people and reports of torture that have been coming out have been getting worse. So if the Tajik government feels like it can continue to act with impunity and they have this surveillance equipment that China has given them and they have pressure from China to control the area, my fear is it's going to begin to look more and more like what's going on in the Uyghur area in China.
And Steve Swartha, I'll give you the last word.
And just to contribute the international legal definition here, I think, you know, genocide is the specific intent to destroy a group in whole or in part. So you don't, not to be gruesome, but you don't have to kill the entire population or even most of it in order to meet that definition, as long as you show this special intent and acts like systematically detaining the population, restricting the right to speak the language, and so many other acts, at the very least constitute cultural genocide, which is another conversation. But I think here, given everything that Suzanne has laid out and we've seen since May, I think one could easily talk about crimes against humanity, which is a systematic or a widespread attack on civilians in a deliberate fashion. And so that, I think, with, again, the right sort of resources, we could get accountability in some venues, in some international courts, And we have, you know, so many other serious human rights violations, from the violation of freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, freedom of association, that there's a lot of work to be done. And, you know, in the case of Karakal, Pakistan, luckily it's not that dire, but some of those same fundamental core issues of identity, of the right to education in one's language, those have been raised consistently by the Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. I have to look and see whether they've looked at that in Tajikistan. I know they have in Uzbekistan. So luckily we have a lot of human rights bodies that we can turn to, that we can work with. And I think, I just wanna say thanks that Scholar Circle is covering this, because it needs that kind of sustained attention.
Thank you both very much for joining us. Our guests today have been Steve Swerdlow. Steve Swerdlow is an associate professor of the practice of human rights in the Department of Political Science and International Relations at the University of Southern California. And he is the author of Uzbekistan's Religious and Political Prisoners and Uzbekistan's Ethnic Minorities, Out of Sight, But Not Out of Mind. And Suzanne Levy-Sanchez, visiting scholar at Harvard University's Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies. She is the author of The Afghan Central Asia Borderlands, The State and Local Leaders, Bridging State and Civil Society, Informal Organizations in the Tajik-Afghan Badashan, and The Assassination That Shook the Pamir Mountains to the Core. Thank you both very much for joining us. Stay with us. Welcome back to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker.
How can international actors compel states to protect human rights? As a legal issue, lawyers have played a creative and essential role at advancing the universality of human rights in light of really what's been a mixed record of national protections. Scholar Circle founder and personal friend, Maria Armudian, has written a wonderful new book on the role that attorneys have played in advancing international human rights. The book is called Lawyers Beyond Borders, Advancing International Human Rights Through Local Laws and Courts. Maria Armudian is a lecturer at the University of Auckland in New Zealand, and of course is the host and anchor of this show, Scholar Circle. Maria, thank you so much for being able to join us.
What fun it is to be on my, you know, program that now you are the host of.
Well, no, thank you. It's an honor to be able to interview you. The first question, you really portray an incredible creativity on the part of lawyers to be able to find courts that would consider themselves to have the jurisdiction to actually hear these cases. Just how creative have these international human rights lawyers been?
First of all, you were talking about the Westphalian system and national sovereignty and all of these ideas, really. You know, we adhere to these ideas as if they are facts. And one of the things in researching this book is just how they become a reality until somebody comes along with a better idea. Or maybe it's not a better idea, but is persuasive enough because of the creative way they have framed these issues and juxtaposed them against the problems of the day. The creativity aspect, I mean, the story of Peter Weiss is fairly well known in the legal circles, but not as well known in the rest of the world. I think one of the most important things here is to say that the story that I tell in Lawyers Beyond Borders is pretty uniquely American. And what I mean by that is that the civil rights movement, you know, was alive and well, and lawyers were using civil litigation to advance rights for those whose rights had been trampled upon. You know, you start, if you go back into, you know, the 1950s when they passed Brown versus Board of Education, for example, and they managed to get segregation declared illegal. This, as these rights were being built for one group, the lawyers would then say, okay, there are enough lawyers working on this area. there are other groups that also need representation and have had their rights also trampled upon. And so they kept looking for ways to advance rights for other groups. And these lawyers in the book are that of that ilk. They are civil rights lawyers. And Peter Weiss was in a unique position. And I always say I had the great honor to interview him. He's in his 90s. He did this particular case that started this movement in the US in 1979. The decision was in 1980. It's called Falardiga versus Peña Irala. Weiss was steeped in both movements, the human rights movement and the US civil rights movement. And so he had this unique purview of the ideas that were fueling the international human rights movement. One of those ideas was the idea of universal jurisdiction. This is key, right? Universal jurisdiction, of course, just means that some crimes are so heinous and so awful that they should be prosecuted anywhere and everywhere. And to him, he calls that the constitution of the world, part of the constitution of the world. So he just needed ways to test that, because these were all test cases in the United States to see how far they could expand these rights. Could he actually represent what they call foreign cubed, a case that was foreign cubed, represent people who were foreign? So the plaintiff is foreign, the defendant was foreign, the wrong was committed in a foreign country. And he thought, well, in some cases, it would fall under universal jurisdiction. How can I do that? So he and his colleagues at the Center for Constitutional Rights unearthed the Alien Tort Statute, which really was a simple law that the first Congress passed when they were talking about the jurisdiction of the judiciary, right? Like, what can the federal courts do? And they said, you know, aliens have access to our courts. The federal courts have jurisdiction when those violations, those torts, the civil wrongs, when they violate international law. And he thought, well, that is just a good, just as good of a, you know, universal jurisdiction statute that I could ever find. And so he tested it. And it was through the Court of Appeals that they said, yep, torture is one of those horrific crimes. And what had happened in the Falardiga case was that Juanito Falardiga was a teenager, and he was tortured to death by a military man in Paraguay. His father, Joel Falardiga, and his sister, Dolly Falardiga, had come to the U.S. looking for the torturer, Peña Irala, and did find him. They managed to find him so they could serve him papers and take him to court and get a judgment, and then get him deported. Well, that meant that they weren't going to collect the $10 million judgment, but it did mean that they got him out of the United States, and they got a sort of declarative victory, a moral victory. They didn't get their boy back. You know, Juanito was dead and died a horrible death, but it was something. And that's what these lawyers have continued to do.
You raised an issue that I'd like to sort of explore a bit too, is in a lot of these cases, I mean, these are civil cases. So this, yes. You know, this is a civil court, not a criminal court, right. Which means even if the defendant is found liable, not guilty, but liable, the penalty is frequently a monetary penalty and almost never, except in some cases with corporations, almost never gets paid. And so you raise the question about punishment. And of course, some notion of justice. Whenever I think of these cases, though, I wonder, is this really about discovery, about establishing legally what happened so that there is a narrative that, you know, in the case you cited in the Falardiga case, we know the facts now because it's been established in a court. Is that the primary motivation? So kind of a naming and shaming, or how much actual punishment can be attached to this?
Well, I think, first of all, it's different for every plaintiff, right? For every survivor of a human rights violation. But I think that what has happened through this process, which started with Peter Weiss and then grew and changed and was creatively altered from that point until today by the follow-up lawyers. But one of the ideas that came out of this process was actually put forward by Senator Kennedy, and then it was put forward by a therapist who said, you know, one of the things that happens when people are violated egregiously, like with torture, is that their agency is just essentially destroyed. And part of this process actually is meant to restore agency. It's meant to transform the person from victim to plaintiff, and then to point a finger at their accuser and say, you did this, and have a court say to them, yes, he did this, and it was wrong. And that has some kind, for some people, restorative effect. Now, if that person happens to have money, assets, and it's a big judgment, you know, a lot of times people who've been violated are not able to work in normal ways, you know, so it helps to put back together a life that might have been destroyed. And this would be the case, for example, in some of these indigenous communities where their lives were completely upended by, say, you know, oil exploration or pipeline infrastructure or, you know, all kinds of things like this, where, you know, they can no longer live the lives that they were living in their indigenous culture. Some of them were subsistence farmers because they can't grow anything anymore, but they've also been violated so badly that there's a sense of loss of agency and trauma, PTSD. So they, I would say there are multiple reasons for this. And when they did settle with some of the corporations and some of the private contractors in the war on terror cases, there was monetary redress. And in one case, one of the violator had come to the United States and had won the lottery, and they got all that money. And so there are cases where there are assets. And so there is a punishment in a way. And yes, it establishes the facts for if there is a criminal prosecution down the line, that is one of the things that can happen. They can feed this into criminal prosecutions, but I think it's mostly victim-centered. It's mostly, you know, and also as the civil rights movement was trying to do, trying to establish law, good law that gives people rights. And so frequently, the survivors have nowhere else to go, nowhere else to get justice. Their own countries are not, you know, set up with proper courts. The international courts are not necessarily, you know, set up in a way that everybody's going to get, you know, properly heard. So this was just one additional route, one more pathway to justice.
One of the things that it's always been a concern of mine broadly, and your book raises this as well, is the role the U.S. has played as the jurisdiction, as this universal jurisdiction, in particular through the Alien Torts Statute. You asserted this question about universal jurisdiction, and what makes the ATS so unique is it has this universal jurisdiction, which is another way of saying Americans don't have to be involved in the case at all, as the plaintiff, as the defendant, and certainly not the location of the human rights violation for American courts to hear the case. How problematic is that?
I don't have a problem with it at all, actually, but the Supreme Court has had a problem with it. And that is why it has handed down some judgments that have said, the Alien Tort Statute needs, for these cases to move forward, it has to touch and concern the United States. However, that said, that has made it really difficult to, you know, confront corporations for their roles in these human rights violations. And there were several cases like this. However, in the 90s, started in the 1980s, actually, but by the 1990s, 96, I believe it was, Congress was actually quite excited about this concept of universal jurisdiction and passed, and George Bush the first signed into law, a follow-up statute to support the Alien Tort Claims Act. called the Torture Victim Protection Act. And so in this case, what they said was, we want to expand this to also include Americans who might have been harmed abroad, but also we want this to be model legislation for other countries so that torturers have nowhere to go. And no matter where they go, their victims can find them and sue them. Well, that became law. And the issue with it is that you can take on individuals if you can find them and serve them papers and get them into a court of law. But that is where the corporate part does not get addressed at all. And they're frankly where the big problems are often. I will say, however, there was a big case against Syria that found Syria, well, liable for, gosh, I can't remember how many dollars it was. It was upwards of $200 million. In the case of targeted killing of a journalist, of Marie Colvin, her sister sued the Syrian Republic. So that is a case in which the court did allow it to go through.
You're listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing international human rights and legal remedies with Maria Armudian, who's written a new book called Lawyers Beyond Borders. Maria, I know there's similar cases like Terry Anderson suing Iran for being seized as a hostage. But one of the challenges here, when you mentioned contemporary cases, the Supreme Court heard a couple of cases, and actually we got the ruling in June of this year, of two corporations that had benefited from child labor, Nestle v. Dole and Cargill v. Doe. And one of the challenges here seems to be that the court wasn't convinced that simply benefiting from the human rights violation is enough to punish the corporation.
Or hold civilly liable, because they weren't really punishing, really, right? They were just trying to hold them civilly liable.
Right. So, I mean, isn't that just one of the challenges generally? Go ahead.
Sorry. Again, it is the Supreme Court making law, right? And that's the issue of extraterritoriality that we were talking about earlier, in which the Supreme Court said, in order to use the Alien Tort Statute, the issue has to touch and concern the United States. And what does that mean exactly, right? So in previous cases, the lower courts, the appellate courts, had allowed cases to move forward when the decision was made in the United States, because that's the decision that, you know, then, especially if it was knowingly made that people were going to be killed or tortured or something like that, massacred. But this time the court did not allow that to be enough to touch and concern the United States. There are some lawyers that are really great who were subject to this book. One is Paul Hoffman, who teaches at University of California, Irvine. He's the guy who argued that before the Supreme Court, and he's one of the key lawyers involved in this movement.
The book is, and you acknowledge this, it's pretty American-centric in this approach. And this actually was more, you know, a criminal prosecution rather than a civil case. Immediately, one case that comes to mind was the rather famous case of the attempt to extradite Augusto Pinochet, the former Chilean strongman dictator, by the Spanish judge Baltasar Garzón. One of the concerns with that, though, was, of course, here's Spain trying, at least a Spanish judge, trying to try a Chilean general. To outsiders, it looked awfully neocolonial. If you're not going to prosecute your own crimes, we'll prosecute them for you. How much is that a concern? Yeah, you said that you weren't as concerned because you wanted to see these cases brought forward, but there's clearly a power component in what country is actually hearing these cases.
So I think two things on that. There is that argument, but again, I think that we've got to heed the pain and suffering of the survivors. And if they cannot get any kind of justice anywhere else in the world, who is going to hear the case? Who is at least going to hear them? And so somebody has to step up. By the way, Spain doesn't do this anymore. And, you know, one of the lawyers in the book, Almudena Bernabeu, who's remarkable as well, she tried to bring a case for a woman whose brother was killed in Syria. And this was to get around the jurisdictional issues, because Spain said, similar to the Supreme Court of touch and concern in terms of extraterritoriality, that the victim has to be Spanish. And in this case, the sister lost her brother, but they said it wasn't enough. So Spain's not even doing these cases anymore. However, Germany is doing some. So it is really interesting to see how far we go. Now, back to what I was trying to do with the book. Now, obviously, it's a political history, and it's a political history of a particular movement. And I focused on the Americas because I found it such a profound effort to do something when nobody else was doing anything. But it's also, like I said earlier on, it's a story that is American in that it's about making rights. It's about building rights. And from kind of a ground floor or negative ground floor. And what does it take to build rights? You know, if somebody tests the case, if you can get an affirmative judgment, then other lawyers come on and they go, oh, well, maybe we can do another case. And then you get more and more lawyers and more cases. And then you've got a fabric of rights. And once you've got that fabric of rights, then you can go, oh, well, where else can this apply? That's what fascinated me the most. Now, of course, what you're getting at now is also that even these American lawyers, even Peter Weiss, was so frustrated, particularly with the war on terror, that he went abroad and helped set up an NGO to do similar kinds of things with universal jurisdiction, which is, and Germany was the place where he found the best statute. So it is happening to some degree in Europe. It's a completely different system. It's not the civil litigation system that the Americans have, which we sort of evolved out of the Brits.
One of the developments that have come out of the ATS cases and what you're describing here has been this call for some sort of a universal court that can hear these cases. The International Court of Justice, of course, can only hear cases with nations withstanding, and the International Criminal Court, which has in many ways been politically compromised, but they can hear criminal cases if you expand this. Should the focus be on more international jurisdiction, you know, perhaps through the UN system? I know there's been a couple of proposals, you know, on this. So an example on corporations is, I mean, there's been a treaty that's been proposed at the UN for years, authored by John Ruggie, who just sadly just passed away. But the so-called draft norms treaty, yeah, that would give the UN the capability to at least, I mean, the UN can hear petitions, maybe even possibly be a court. I understand your argument that it's about political viability right now. And right now, you know, the US has offered at least an avenue, which is better than nothing. Should the legal focus be on trying to create international institutions that can hear these cases?
Look, I think that is important. And as you note, there are some politically compromised issues that arise in those systems as well, including at the United Nations. So yes, we should have international systems, and we should find ways to limit those kinds of political compromises that are happening. But I think at the same time, creatively finding ways in other jurisdictions is fine. Finding ways to apply universal jurisdiction is good. And I say that again because it is not okay. It is not morally okay to leave millions of people without recourse and without redress. And the system right now, under this sovereign nation system, makes it nearly impossible for so many people to get any sort of justice, to get their lives back, to get their agency back, to get their bodies back. So something has to be done, and something has to be done kind of quickly. And so I think expedience is what drove these lawyers to do it in the United States. It's where they were. It's what they could do. It's the tools that they had. And so let's do something for somebody.
And that really is the narrative of the book, is the use of these creative uses to find some form, some avenue of justice for victims. So even issues I'm raising is asking, is there a better way to do it? Not
probably.
Probably
it probably is, but it would take a very long time, Doug. And I think that's what I'm getting at, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, do you want to wait until all the victims are dead and have suffered and their families are suffering? And then there's, you know, all the sort of communal post-traumatic stress. And then, of course, there's the epigenetic transference of trauma. You know, it's like, how long do people have to wait? Do they have to wait for, you know, how long did John Rogge work on this? And he has passed on, and hopefully somebody will pick up the baton. But really, can we really expect something to happen like tomorrow? No. So there should be other ways that we can make a difference. There should be other means that people can get justice. And, you know, the American court system was one of them. And now it's not as strong. That might change. It could change. I hope it does. Because there are a lot of survivors that come to the United States as refugees. And you know what? Guess what? So do their torturers. They come here too, and they end up living here. And in one of the cases, there was a young woman who was, she had taken refuge in Atlanta, Georgia, took a job in a hotel. And guess what? So did her torturer. The guy who tortured her was working at that same hotel. Now, how much peace does she get? Shouldn't she be able to sue him? With the Torture Victim Protection Act, she can.
The book is called Lawyers Beyond Borders, Advancing International Human Rights Through Local Laws and Courts. The author is Maria Armudian, lecturer at the University of Auckland in New Zealand, and a host, anchor, and creator of this show, The Scholar Circle. Thank you very much, Maria.
Thanks so much, Doug. This was great fun.
Special thanks to the Scholar Circle team, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongri, webmaster and production assistant,
and Mahika Chechi is our intern.
All Scholar Circle shows are archived on scholarcircle.org. You can find our podcast on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle Twitter account, and please join our Facebook page. On behalf of the Scholar Circle team, I am Doug Becker. Thank you for listening.